I'd like to begin in the traditional style of Homage to the Buddha. So this is the standard verse of Homage to the Buddha in the Pali language. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, good evening everyone, and I want to express my thanks for the hospitality that I've received from the Buddhist people of Seattle that I've met so far. This is actually my second time in Seattle, although the first time goes back to 1965, when with the number of fellow students from Brooklyn College, we were heading to San Francisco, and we drove a car across country from Brooklyn, New York, which was to be delivered in Seattle. When we arrived in Seattle, we delivered the car, and without spending another minute in the city of Seattle. In those days, you could get onto the road and stick out your thumb and hitchhike your way down, and we hitchhiked down to San Francisco. Yeah, the theme, or the talk that I want to give this evening stems from a particular problem that many of us have found in adopting and practicing the Dhamma, the Buddha's teaching. And so there seems to be a certain tension between two aspirations or aims that come through our practice, at least as I found in my own case. One is the aspiration for what we call spiritual development, awakening, enlightenment, realization, liberation. And the other, which I found to become increasingly important in my own life, is the aspiration for the transformation of the larger context in which a practice is undertaken. That is the aspiration to create a more peaceful society, a more just society, a more sustainable culture, a world that is able to provide for everyone and to enable everyone to live in harmony. I found the sort of tension between these two aspirations to play out in my own life. I'm now 70 years old, and if you trace back the time when I first became interested in Buddhism, about the middle 1960s, this was a time of momentous conflict and changes taking place in American society, and I found myself right in the midst of this turmoil that was taking place. Particularly, this was the period of the war in Vietnam, and I was a strong advocate of terminating the war in Vietnam. And it was also the era in which the civil rights movement had taken off and was gaining momentum. And so I found myself involved particularly in the anti-war movement. But then as my involvement with Buddhism increased, I found that it was more important, at least I thought then, to work on myself, particularly after I became a monk. Then I sort of put aside any involvement in external activities, and I devoted myself to the study of the Dhamma, learning the canonical languages of Buddhism, and the practice of meditation. And particularly, I spent more than 20 years in Sri Lanka, and living in Sri Lanka, you don't want to be articulate about your political views at all. Okay, but even during my last years in Sri Lanka, I became increasingly concerned about developments that were taking place in the world. And then I returned to the United States in 2002, where I, for the first time, I really gained access to the internet. And so I was able to get very concrete images, streams of information about what is taking place in the world. And then this was right after very soon after the attack on the World Trade Center in New York, the enactment of the Patriot Act, the launch of the war in first in Afghanistan, then in Iraq, and then spreading throughout other parts of the Middle East. And so this became a matter of deep concern to me. And so I found that after, you know, starting with deep social concerns and going through a period of withdrawal and sort of detachment from these concerns, that these came to tug more and more deeply at what we call the strings of my heart. So I came to see that it's necessary for our practice to be complete, for us to have a truly integral practice, to try to bring together these two concerns, the concern for our own purification, development of inner wholesome qualities, development of wisdom, loving kindness, compassion, and also to be able to address these to bring the qualities that emerge in our practice to bear upon the momentous, challenging, overwhelming problems that confront us out in the world today. And I came to see that there are what I would call two unsatisfactory approaches to these problems, which pertain to, let's say, are diametrically opposed to each other. One of them is to adopt the idea that merely through our spiritual practice, by developing more mindfulness, by generating feelings of loving kindness and compassion in our personal and private life, that through this alone, we can transform the world without addressing deep underlying structures. The other opposed approach is to think that merely by changing the systems, by changing policies, by voting a new team of rogues into office, without implementing deep changes in our own consciousness, that we can transform the situation in the world and avoid calamity. Because there's this constant, inextricable interplay and interdependence between the inner dimension of our lives and the outer manifestation of conditions in the world, so that we could say that the conditions of our mind sort of emanate outwards and affect situations in the world. They become manifest in institutions, social structures, political forms, economic policies, foreign policy, and so forth. All are sort of concrete manifestations of states of mind. But the world, with its institutions, systems, policies, and so on, also flow in upon us and change our mind, influence our mind. And so there's this constant, you could call it almost a whirlpool, a cyclical play between outer conditions and inner states of mind. And so to address the outer conditions, we have to transform states of mind. But merely by transforming our minds will not be sufficient unless we also use bring our perspectives, our attitudes, our values to bear upon those larger domains that condition the nature of life within society, culture, and the world at large. And so to resolve the problems that face us in the world today, it's necessary for us to engage in what I would call critical thinking, because our current social, cultural, and political system has become infected by a very dangerous pathologies. So this pathology has become so insidious and so tenacious that it even threatens to bring down all of human civilization. In fact, we are now at currently at very, very dangerous levels. And so in order to be able to change the systems in which we're living, we have to understand them, which means we have to engage in a process of diagnosis. And the diagnosis begins first by looking at the symptoms. And we could say, you know, some of the symptoms have just become so routinized that we're almost not aware of them. They form almost a kind of quiet, constant background to our everyday lives, a background to which we're constantly exposed, but because of such frequent exposure, the events that are taking place hardly cause any ripples in our mind. So some of the symptoms, just to mention a few of them, the most insidious of them, we have perpetual wars, you know, wars going on for decades, well, at least more than a decade, in Afghanistan, Iraq, other countries in the Middle East, where people's lives, you know, hundreds and thousands of lives have already been lost. Millions of people have been driven from their homes into other countries, into homelessness. Social structures that provided for the well-being of millions of people have been obliterated. And this is constantly going on. And yet, when we see news about attacks in this country, that a country, at least in my experience, unless it's very brutal, very egregious, we hardly pay attention to them. But this is the result of policies, decisions, which come from the seats of power, decisions that we have a responsibility to transform. Another manifestation or symptom is the ever-expanding, even obscene gap between the super-rich, the very small, powerful, extremely wealthy elite, which has now become a transcontinental elite, global elite, and the great number of people whose incomes are being decimated, whose holdings, whose wealth are diminishing. So that in many, many countries, including this country, the status of the middle class, which had been the main pillar of American life, has become very precarious. Just the other day, I read an article that was appeared in The Guardian, online Guardian, that currently 1% of the world's population owns 50% of the world's wealth, and that's the top 1% owns 50% of the world's wealth, and the bottom 50% of the world's population owns 1% of the world's wealth. Okay, so we have this gap between the super rich and everyone else. The third symptom is climate change, escalating climate change, which is actually, you know, threatening the very foundations of human civilization. And if it continues to escalate, you know, we're going to meet with disasters and crises on a scale that, as a species, we've never experienced before. Okay, there are other manifestations of this pathology that are more specific. The increased racism, particularly in relation between black people and the police in this country, the xenophobia, the antagonism towards immigrants, the surveillance systems, which are constantly monitoring all of our movements. not only by the political powers, but by the corporations, seeing through our choices on the internet, what our preferences, and constantly bombarding us with advertisements to appeal to our preferences. Just the other day, you know, our Buddhist Global Relief, we changed our mailing address about 2 weeks ago. And just before I left New York to come here, we got a packet from the post office, you know, asking for confirmation of the change of address. When I opened it up, I found not only the slip announcing the change of address, but there were about 25 slips of paper from different commercial firms saying that now that you've moved to a new home, one from furniture company, from bank, the Chase Bank, saying open your bank account with us. A furniture company, all sorts of corporations which are putting their advertisements within the post office, the packet from the post office. And then what's become especially frightful in this country is the spread of the gun culture, so that we have, you know, more guns than people in the United States, and these killings that are taking place have become horrific. Almost every day, killings are taking place, and almost every week, some type of mass killing is taking place. You know, so how do we understand these problems? And as I reflected upon them, I made up a little chart to sort of diagnose them, these problems in my own mind, to understand them for myself. I wanted to have a projector so that I could project my chart so that everybody could see it. Now I have to rely upon the table that I have in front of me and my powers of description. But what seemed to me to be underlying all of these problems is what I would call an inversion in the scheme of values that govern human existence. And when I looked at the problem from this perspective, I came to divide what I call the domains of value into four levels, or four spheres, which I call, first I'll enumerate what the spheres are, then I'll explain them, starting from the most fundamental, the most basic, and going upwards. So starting at the foundation, we have what I call the natural sphere or the ecological sphere. Then building upon this, the social sphere. Then on top of this, the symbolic and cultural sphere. And then on top of that, at the apex of this particular stratification, the ultimate sphere, the sphere of ultimate value. Okay, so those are the four domains. And then as to their meaning, okay, the ecological sphere or the natural sphere, I divide into two subsidiary systems. So one is the geosphere, which is the sphere of inanimate nature, which is the foundation of all life, of all sentient existence on Earth. So in order for life to flourish on Earth, we need the right set of geographical conditions, of ecological conditions, the proper temperature, sufficient amount of water, sufficient amount of land, and so on. And then the other sphere within, or domain within the ecological sphere, is the biosphere. So this is the sphere of non-human life, well, also including human life in its biological aspect, which is based upon the geosphere. So we have the ecological sphere and natural sphere comprising the geosphere and the biosphere. Okay, then based upon this is the social sphere. And this comprises all the systems that arise from and express human relationships and shared endeavors. So the social sphere comprises the projects that unite us to achieve common purposes. Then we have the third sphere is the symbolic and cultural sphere. And this comprises the symbolic systems that facilitate human participation in the other three spheres. So this includes language, all of the expression, the arts, all of the symbols that we use to engage in our social interactions and to facilitate our mastery over the ecological sphere, the social sphere, and even the ultimate sphere. Okay, then the ultimate sphere is the sphere of what I call ultimate meaning. So this we could say is the source of truth, goodness, and beauty, the domain of highest vision and aspiration. Okay, now each of these four primary spheres has its own proper value. What strikes me is that, you know, when we speak about Dharma, usually we think Dharma means the teaching of the Buddha. But the word Dharma comes from the Sanskrit root dharati, which means to support, to uphold. And for this reason, the word Dharma has a much broader meaning than the narrow of specific meaning of the Buddha's teaching. In Indian culture, Dharma refers to, in the broader sense, to that universal law of rightness, goodness, and truth, which upholds and maintains human existence and that enables human beings, human society, to flourish in harmony and to maximize its ultimate value. And so Dharma becomes embodied when the value that pertains to each of the four main spheres is pursued and upheld in the sense of dharati, Dharma as that which supports. Okay, so we have the natural sphere, and its particular type of value is what I call fundamental value. So this is its value in the sense that it's indispensable for life to persist and flourish. The natural sphere is the sphere, the source of food, air, water, energy, the raw materials for buildings, medicine, clothes, trade. All of this derives from the ecological sphere, the natural sphere. Okay, then we come to the social sphere and its proper value. Its proper value is what I call human social value. And this sphere, the value of this sphere is actualized when we are providing for the protection of human beings, when we are enabling human beings to flourish and to realize deeper fulfillment through community, when social relations enable people to pursue their personal and collective aims. Okay, then the symbolic or cultural sphere has its specific value, which is what I call aesthetic value. This is what enables people to experience a deeper sense of meaning through the enjoyment of the arts, through painting, literature, music, a kind of sublimation of the senses. And it also includes those symbolic instruments that enable us to relate to the other three spheres pragmatically, to utilize them to fulfill our proper purposes. Then the highest domain is the domain of ultimate value, and this is what is to bring the deepest fulfillment, the attainment of the true aim of human existence. And according to, from the different spiritual systems, they'll have different conceptions of that aim, whether it be in Buddhism, we speak about enlightenment, liberation, the realization of Nibbana. A Christian might see it as the communion with God. The Hindu would conceive of it as moksha. So different religions will have different perspectives, but all will be directed towards some realization of ultimate value, the embodiment, the experiential realization of truth, goodness, and beauty. Okay, now what has happened? You know, don't forget that the purpose of this diagnosis, of this analysis, is to diagnose what is the particular source of the problems that we are facing today. And the way I see what has happened is that all of these domains of value have been overtaken by an inversion of their proper value, so that their proper value has been corrupted, distorted, subdued, and dominated. What has taken place is that a particular aspect in the sphere of instrumental value, that is, the conception of financial wealth as an instrumental goal, has usurped its proper, has spun out from its proper position and usurped the position of ultimate value, so that all four spheres have now been invaded, colonized, and dominated by the pursuit of financial economic wealth. How does this come about? I see is occurring through what I call a process of double abstraction. Am I getting too abstract here? Okay. Good. Because I'm a frustrated academic. Okay, I speak about a double abstraction that properly that economy should be embedded within the social sphere. You know, it's just a subordinate system of operations within the social sphere. But somehow, perhaps through the period after the Industrial Revolution, it's come to break off and become a domain of itself and taken as, you know, the metric for a healthy society is the health of the economy. Having a robust economy is the measure of a healthy society. So that's the first abstraction. And then the second abstraction is that certain numerical quantities come to be the determinant of a healthy economy, particularly in companies, business operations, the profit margin, shareholder value, and the economy as a whole, the percentage of growth and gross domestic product, GDP, become the measures of a healthy economy. And so as a result of this, we have this inversion of value, distortion of value occurring in each of these four domains. So coming to the natural domain, we find that nature is commodified. It's reduced to natural resources for extraction, transformation into goods, commodities to be sold in the market. And so this is the commodification of nature is what I would call a desecration of nature. And desecration, I think the literal sense is desacralization of nature, so that nature loses its sacred value, its value as something worthy of reverence in itself, and becomes just transformed into an expanse of raw materials to be used to transform into goods to generate more profit within those corporations that extract the sources, the resources of nature. So the executive from a timber corporation or paper corporation comes to Washington State and looks out and sees beautiful natural forest. And does he appreciate the trees, the tall cedars and Douglas firs, and the shade and the leaves, like we saw yesterday in Seward Park? No, he sees so much expanse, so much acreage of trees that could be cut down to be used for lumber or paper. A mining executive comes to the mountains of West Virginia and Kentucky, and does he go into ecstasies over the splendor of the mountains? No, he okay. He sees an obstacle to the extraction of coal to be obtained by blasting those mountains to pieces in order to get the coal. And this also is manifested in the brutalized treatment of animals, which is one of, I'd say, of the gravest sins of humanity, particularly here in the United States, where we have billions of animals cultivated, just kept in cages, or in feedlots, nurtured to the point of maximum growth, and then immediately sent for slaughter to be transformed into food. Okay, so nature, we have this transformation of nature into commodities, which is the inversion of the value, the intrinsic value of the natural world. Then we come to the social sphere, the sphere of human beings and human interaction. And this leads, or becomes manifest, this inversion is manifest in the objectification of people, whereby people become turned into just workers to be assigned to work at jobs, again, to generate more financial wealth, even subjected to demanding hours, over-demanding hours in many parts of the world, inhumane, inhuman working conditions. And then for the more affluent parts of the world, or even those who are not so affluent, but through the lens of this commercialization of our society, people are seen as consumers, workers and consumers. And as consumers, they have to be continually bombarded by messages, informing them, inspiring them with the idea that the path to happiness and contentment lies in buying this, owning that, laying claim to this, even if it has to be purchased by undertaking debt. Okay, and then this becomes, when this is taken on a more collective scale, the objectification of the social sphere. We have the privatization of public services, which has taken place to a very great degree in the so-called developing world, and is now also becoming more and more spreading within the United States. We have to be very, very vigilant to prevent this from happening. So we have the privatization of education, attempts are being made to privatize the post office, even suggestions of privatizing Social Security. And of course, healthcare is completely privatized in this country. And then we have, part of the social sphere, the corporate domination of politics and policies, so that the corporations pretty much dictate policies to the politicians and control them through campaign donations and their lobbyists. Okay, then we come to the symbolic and cultural sphere. We have the corporate control of the media, the exaltation of what's come to be called celebrity culture, the promotion of pop music, very crass pop music with ever-changing styles of music, ever-changing celebrities. So, you know, in the 1980s, when I was in Sri Lanka, through Time magazine, I learned about a person named Madonna. I never got to hear her music, but she was the big thing, even on the cover of Time magazine. Now, I mentioned Madonna a couple of weeks ago, intending to speak about a current celebrity. And people said, where have you been the last two decades? Okay, so I know I don't know her personally, but Taylor Swift is now the current belle du jour. Okay, so we have celebrity culture, the pop music, the cult stars, and the music, sports. So, you know, all of culture then becomes sort of dominated, controlled by the commercial interests. And then when we come to the ultimate sphere, maybe I should try the other type of. It seems like.
The robe's slipping, it's pulling it off your ear. So I'm just undo it from there.
Okay, when we come to the ultimate sphere, the sphere of what I call ultimate value, of the deepest fulfillment, of realization of the ultimate goal of human existence, we have one of the manifestations has been called spiritual materialism. This is the promise of instant enlightenment. You know, you take the weekend course, you're sure to attain enlightenment, a commercially packaged spirituality. I haven't seen it in a while, but I used to see it alongside my Google, something like, if you take this course, we'll have you meditating like a Zen master in days. You know, like Zen masters have to undergo, 15, 20 years of very rigorous training, but now you just, of course you have to pay for the package. And then it probably still goes on, but I'm not so familiar. I don't go to those websites or those magazines anymore, but you get the turning of spirituality into almost like a personality cult, where each personality has to project themselves with inviting one to contribute a certain amount in order to get the package or to get personal instructions or to be given access to the secret of success. But then on the side of the more conservative religious phenomena, there's appeared it's called the theology of wealth. We don't see this very much in Buddhist circles, but it's become one of the dominant manifestations of evangelical Christianity. The idea that, you know, Jesus said that sell all you have and give the wealth to the poor. One who wants to follow me has to bear the cross, not anymore. The sign that you are chosen, one of the chosen, is you're able to succeed in your business and make millions and support the mega church, which costs millions to construct and to sustain. And so in this way, we have what I call this inversion of value extending from the natural sphere, whereby nature becomes commodified, to the social sphere, where human beings become objectified, exploited, treated just as workers, consumers, debtors, investors, to the symbolic sphere, or the cultural sphere, where culture is invaded and governed by commercial interests, to the spiritual sphere, where spirituality becomes a means of generating wealth. Now, I tried to illustrate what's happening with the chart. I don't know if you could see it in the back, but I'll describe it. So this is the way, okay, I can describe it verbally as well. It's a pyramid with four levels. So we have at the base the material security and biological survival, and this is the domain of fundamental value. Then the next level of the pyramid, we have social and emotional fulfillment, the sphere of human value, then aesthetic and intellectual fulfillment, the sphere of symbolic or cultural value, and then spiritual fulfillment, the sphere of ultimate value. This is what I would call the dharmic pattern, the pattern that conforms to Dharma in that most broadest universal sense, whereby what I would say that the values that are upheld by the spiritual sphere or the ultimate sphere sort of spread down through all four levels and govern, determine the proper attitudes towards nature, that of reverence and restrained utilization, because we have to utilize natural resources to survive, down to the social sphere, where people are treated with respect and we form harmonious, peaceful communities whereby we can enrich each other and help each other to fulfillment, to the cultural sphere where we our pursuits are expressed in works of genuine beauty and deep expressions of truth, to the spiritual sphere where we are able to achieve at least spiritual progress, culminating in spiritual realization. But what has occurred is what I call the inversion and perversion of value, so that the pyramid is turned upside down. And what happens, I say that monetary value usurps the topmost position. So it's now spread out over the whole pyramid. It usurps the top position and it colonizes the other domains, so that fundamental value of nature is turned into commodities, human value turns into workers, consumers, and debtors, aesthetic value into crass entertainment and anti-intellectualism, which is, you know, very widespread now in our culture and particularly our politics. You know, so that at least for one political party, to the key to success is to show that you are as dumb, ignorant, stupid as possible. And ultimate value becomes turned into spiritual and religious materialism. Okay, I reflected upon this, again upon this scheme of the inversion of value, and then I inquired what underlies this inversion of value, how did it come about, and what is it that supports it, that gave rise to it and supports it. And based on some of readings that I've done, I came to see what I would call a deep metaprogram or source code underlying this inversion of values. And I don't want to usurp the credit for this myself, but I got these ideas from some thinkers that I've been reading. Perhaps the most influential is a Canadian social philosopher called John McMurtry. Okay, so the deep metaprogram or source code involves, it's a kind of an orientation towards the world, which involves a metaphysic or philosophical perspective, an ethics, an application of the program, and then consequences. The metaphysic is that of personal atomism, which means that the private individual self is an ultimate reality in itself. That human beings, we each have our private individual self, potentially separate from the selves of all other people. And this leads to an objectification of others. So since I possess my own inward private self, I see myself as being the ultimate reality. And I look at all others, I objectify all others with the question in the back of the mind, my mind, how can they serve my interests? So my interests become paramount and others become seen as contributors to the fulfillment of my interests. And so other people become objectified, nature becomes commodified, all to serve the interests of that private, atomic, independent self somehow dwelling inside. Okay, there's the metaphysic, and that metaphysic gives rise to something which is called an ethics, though it seems very unethical, but in the sense of a code that determines behavior, we can call it ethics. So according to this ethic, rational behavior means seeking to maximize one's own private self-interest. And that pits me because I know that other people are also seeking to maximize their individual interests. And since the goods are finite and we can't all maximize the goods, that the consequence of this is that I am inevitably thrown into a state of competition, even brute competition with others. So the key to this ethics is to act in such a way that I come out on top in the competition with others. And there's a kind of justification given for this code of behavior that when each one is seeking to maximize his or her own interest, somehow this is to contribute to the greatest good of the whole. And so we can see how this is contributing to the greatest good of the whole through our incessant wars going on around the world, the expanding gap between the rich and the poor, the accelerating decimation of the natural climate. Okay, the application of the program results in the quest for exponentially increasing returns on investment. John McMurtry uses the expression, he says, multiplying growth of transnational money sequences at ever higher velocities and volumes with no life limits tolerated. And then the consequence of this is the pursuit of infinite growth on a planet, a finite planet, which leads to the desolation of the natural environment, social systems marked by competition, domination, and exploitation, and a broken, unjust economic system. Okay, so what can we do to address this kind of crisis that we're facing? I don't know how my time is because I can't see the clock anymore, and I wanted to leave time for questions. Oh, I see, it's not so bad as I thought. No, I was saying it is 10 after 9 from here. Okay, so what I say to be You know, I'm not a policy expert, so I'm not going to recommend particular lines of policy, but the kind of values that we need to transform this omnivorous system in which we're currently living. So this has to be done through what I would call a double transformation, a transformation of consciousness and the transformation of the enveloping social system. So I've come up with certain factors under the transformation of consciousness. And I relate these to the four domains of value. So I have first respecting natural value, which entails a reverence for the earth, honoring inanimate nature, respecting the beauty, the amazing cohesion of natural systems, their ability to bring forth. I'm going to be a Jain ascetic by the time I get through it. Okay. To bring forth an amazing proliferation of life forms, respect for other species, and restoring a sense of the majesty and sacredness of the cosmos. Okay, so this is respecting natural value, then restoring human value, and the key to this is what I call an affirmation of subjectivity. And this is the converse to what I spoke about as the objectification of other people. Now, what tends to happen is that under the domination of the, what I would call the commercialized meta program, as I said, we look at other people and see them objectified as competitors, as beings to be exploited for our own advantage. But now if we have a deep sensitivity to other beings, especially other human beings, we see them as centers of subjective experience. And that means when we see them as centers of subjective experience, as beings like ourselves, each of them the center of a world, the center of a universe, each one experiencing pain, experiencing pleasure, seeking happiness, averse to suffering, then this can lead to empathy, a deep identification with others. And it's that deep identification which becomes the basis for true loving kindness and compassion. And so from the affirmation of subjectivity, recognizing other people as centers of subjective experience, there emerges a new way of relating to others, which is a way that I call intersubjective solidarity. So that instead of seeing others as competitors, as rivals, or as people to be exploited for our own advantage, we unite with them in subjective experience and collaborate with them to fulfill our common purposes. Okay, so this is restoring human value. Then comes the rediscovery of aesthetic and intellectual value, which truly needs, for that to occur, it truly needs a process of proper education so that people's tastes can be refined and sublimated so that they could appreciate proper, truly great art, literature, music, and be weaned away from the crass, commercialized pop music, art, and what passes for culture nowadays. And also, once we have it changed, transformations in the economic system so that people will have more leisure and not be compelled to work long hours, excessive hours of degrading types of work, they'll have more time, more leisure through which they can appreciate genuine art and works of beauty, expressions of human genius. Okay, and then we need the seeking of ultimate value. Again, that requires a certain amount of leisure and education and a certain base of stability through establishing just economic systems so that people are not in positions of economic desperation, so that they have the leisure and opportunity to pursue truly deep and substantial modes of spiritual cultivation, not the passing commercialized, popularized fads, which are here today and gone tomorrow, with their false promises, their glittering promises, with promises that are easily and quickly broken. Okay, so these are some steps to transforming consciousness. But consciousness itself cannot really be transformed in a vacuum, because we live in an ambient, enveloping social order with political, economic, cultural, and social domains. And so those have to undergo changes as well. Okay, and these changes in the system arise through what I would call the recognition of relatedness. So this is the antidote to the sort of the contrary model that I spoke of the privatized self, the self that exists enclosed within itself and merely seeks its own gratification. So through the recognition of relatedness and interdependence, then we come, and the mutuality between human beings and nature, and the connections between individual human beings, then we see that we have to collaborate and work together to transform the system. And the transformations in the system occur predominantly through the exaltation of two values. The two values work hand in hand together. One is what I would call awakening the sense of global justice, which is founded upon proper ethics, and the other is inspiring solidarity based on universal love and compassion. Okay, the sense of global justice arises from recognizing the essential equality of all human beings, recognizing that everybody, no matter what their race, ethnicity, nationality, origins, religion, are essentially the same as human beings. And therefore, since we are all essentially the same, we have to secure the well-being of all human beings. And to secure the well-being of all human beings, again, this has, I see it as having two dimensions, two subsidiary aspects, which are actually embodied or expressed within the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. One comes from Article 25 of the Declaration, which states that all people are entitled to adequate food, housing, medical care, and security, physical security. So Article 25 is designed to ensure that all human beings are able to live healthy, secure, productive lives. And Article 26 holds that all human beings have the right to a free education at least through the levels of primary and secondary school. And it's through, if the right to food, housing, and medical care secures the life of human beings, it's Article 26, the right to education, which ensures that human beings, people, are able to maximize, to unfold their own potentials, to realize their own potentials, and in this way, to maximize the meaning and value of their lives. So the obligation to fulfill the requirement of global justice means ensuring that all human beings live healthy and secure lives, and through the right to education, that they can lead meaningful and fulfilling lives, and to realize their, what would be called, their God-given potentials. Okay, then, global justice is somewhat of a cool and objective decree, but to soften the harshness of that decree comes the, what I call the spirit of solidarity based on universal love and compassion. So this is the cultivating the ability to feel along with others, recognizing the subjectivity of others, and thereby experiencing in our own hearts the sufferings of others and feeling compelled, driven, inspired to work for the well-being and happiness of others at all levels. Okay, so these are the qualities, some of the qualities we need to transform the system. And as the system is transformed through the implementation of these qualities, then we move from an economy which is directed towards endless growth and towards the maximization of profit, particularly corporate profit, and maximize and expanding that gap between the super rich and everybody else. We move towards an economy governed by the principle of sufficiency. The principle of sufficiency means one knows when enough is enough, which doesn't mean that growth completely comes to a stop, but it means that the aim of the economy becomes growth, development in the quality of life, not in ever-expanding production and consumption. Okay, so these are some of the thoughts that I've been having. If it sounds a little crazy to you, please just recognize I'm a little bit of a crazy monk. So, and that when monks are alone in their room, they're too much. Spending long periods of time alone in their room, they can come up with crazy thoughts. Then you could just dismiss me with those thoughts. Okay, I think we might have some time for questions. Is that just the case? Okay, I see one, two, and then way in the back. First we'll start in the second row, then the third row, and then way in the back. It's probably helpful so that everybody can hear. Is there a mobile microphone?
No.
No. Then if you just speak loudly, that would be helpful.
I can just speak loudly.
Yeah, just speak loudly.
I'm just interested in how you would juxtapose this with kind of what David Lloyd talks about, which is the, maybe it's the cultural sphere that he's talking about or something, but it overlays on your, as it overlays on your scheme, but the, he says sort of the collective ego or consciousness that is, that has the same sort of aspects as an individual consciousness or something like that.
I'm not quite sure that I would know what to say unless I saw, you know, exactly what he said, and then...
He calls it the we go, you know,
yeah.
So it's kind of the, it's sort of how...
Oh, I see. So that what we have to do is to move from the ego as the individual to the we go.
Well, he also talks about it as just a way to understand maybe the larger context,
yeah,
of how things happen in society. So
that, yeah.
So that the, there is a sort of a collective self, and that, that kind of affects how things run.
I mean, I could see this in two from two different perspectives. I'm not sure that I'm exactly speaking to his, David Loy's own idea. So David Loy, he's a good friend of mine. We've had numerous discussions. But exactly this expression, I don't remember. I could see it in one sense in that we have, you know, the collective ego, the we-go, as emerging of individual concerns in ways that are oppositional to others. So that we have, you know, the expression in expressions in the form of racism, so we're white people against black, brown, red people. That's one form of a kind of collective egotism, or we are Americans, the exceptional people, the exceptional nation. We have the right to interfere in the internal affairs of all other countries. What are some other expressions? We are, you know, well, there are different forms of collective ego. So that is one kind of, maybe we go, the kind of harmful expression of greater sense than one's own private self. And then there could be a we go in the sense of what I was speaking about, of inter-subjective solidarity, whereby we identify with others, share the concerns of others, and then work for the well-being and happiness of others out of a sense that others are just as important as we are. Okay, you please.
Thank you so much for, yeah, such wise words. Mm. I'd like to start by apologizing if I cannot express myself so well, because I come from Brazil and English is not my language. Mm. But it was very inspiring to listen to you. Last year, I did my master's on Buddhism and human rights. Mm. And I used many of your quotations. So it's very, very important.
Yeah, yeah.
Religion has stepped up in a very vicious way.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And it's very unfortunate, though Buddhism has reached once again the West. Mm. And the message, core message that I believe Buddhism brings, is fraternity, compassion, mm, and non-violence.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
The main difference that Buddhism has, yeah, to other religions.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty tall question. It's very well expressed. You don't have to have any concerns about your English. In a way, I would reiterate some of the points that I brought out in my talk, and I would say that Buddhism asks us to view our situation from a double perspective, One is from concern for our own well-being and happiness, but to be able to distinguish what is our well-being and happiness. And what's happened in the West, particularly the United States, through the domination of the materialistic way of thinking, is that people identify their well-being and the path to happiness in enhancing their wealth, their status, their material well-being. And so, because material well-being, you know, there is finite in quantity, this is what pits people in conflict with one another. Okay, so first, if we distinguish what is a true well-being and happiness, and we don't have to think in terms of, you know, the loftiest goal, you know, enlightenment, full realization, nibbana, but I would say that that true well-being and happiness comes from, at least from the elementary level, living a whole a wholesome and virtuous life, being able to live in harmony with others, to establish mutually fulfilling projects with others, to establish deep, meaningful human relationships, and then on that basis to develop good qualities of the mind and heart, even if we suspend such matters as enlightenment, nibbana, but at least developing qualities of generosity, kindness towards others, contentment, ability to share with others. So these are some of the qualities that bring true happiness and a sense of well-being within ourselves. And then following the middle way, which means establishing a secure foundation of material well-being, but not letting material goals and the continued inexhaustible enhancement of material wealth become the guide and final governing goal of our existence, but balancing material well-being with the achievement of an ethical life and the pursuit of inner cultivation. So that is our own well-being, and then fulfilling, promoting the well-being and happiness of others as being, in some ways, contributing to our own happiness. And so when we could see the harmonization of the pursuit of our own good with the pursuit of the good of others, and that the fulfillment of our own good and the good of others comes through cooperation, harmony, kindness, sharing, generosity, I think this is at least one contribution that Buddhism can make to resolving these conflicts. Okay.
There's a lot of effort to undo the environmental madness.
Yeah.
However, in my office, even though everybody's kind to each other, communication is completely broken down. The people with the money don't necessarily agree with what we do, and so we don't take the chance to say, no, this is what we do, and if you don't want it, go away. We take the money, right? So there's this conflict of survival. And then we don't communicate well, and
yeah.
Things aren't always running well, people aren't agreeing with each other, it's complete madness.
Yeah.
It drives me crazy because I have these high ideals, exactly what you're talking about, and being spoken about all over the world, but people aren't actually practicing this. They're talking about it, and then it just sort of sits there. As a model, we turn somewhere else because it's easier, right? So how do we begin? Yeah.
And
other than, you know, me practicing that,
yeah.
I go into an office, nobody else is practicing. it makes me crazy. And it makes me not hopeful. Because I don't see people coming to talks like this and going, yes, I want to take that just back to work. You know? I don't know if that's a question or just a question.
Yeah, so I can say it as an observation, because I think many people have those problems. How to resolve that kind of problem, I was going to say I don't know, because I don't have experience, you know, working in an office, but then it occurred to me that, you know, you look from the outside at a monastery, you think, oh, everybody is living in harmony and peace there. But there are lots of conflicts in monasteries. But one thing that's what's done in monasteries, maybe this can be applied to an office, is to get, okay, once a week to have meetings where everybody sits down and airs their grievances, and then having made a prior pledge or commitment that we're going to resolve our conflicts, our disagreements peacefully, you know, without yelling and shouting at each other, without dividing into opposed factions and backbiting against each other. So this is an idea that one might apply to the office, to get people to meet and, you know, discuss their problems, their disagreements, their differences, and try to resolve them in ways that will contribute to the, that will enable the team to function together harmoniously. Okay, please. Yeah, yeah.
So sometimes when I'm talking to wealthy people about their wealth addiction problem, I find that I am not very skillful in speaking to them about that in a way that allows them to see that I really care about their well-being.
Yeah.
Can you talk about how to communicate these ideas to somebody in the 1% that really believes that being in the 1% is a good thing?
Again, I don't have practical experience talking to people in the 1%. Sometimes I wish that I did. Let me think about that. Yeah, I can't come up with a ready answer. Of course, one way could be, it's very difficult, I say, because people who are living in the 1% become sort of ensconced within that particular worldview that sort of justifies their sense of entitlement to their wealth and their resistance to any challenges to it. So perhaps what has to be done is to enable them to perhaps to see the suffering that people, especially in the poorer countries of the world, or even in the poorer strata of society within the United States, the sufferings that they are undergoing, and to get them to ask themselves whether they really can feel satisfied and content with themselves, living in a world in which we do have the wealth to obliterate global poverty, but the particular system that it allows a few to amass enormous wealth is what keeps people living in such degrading, dehumanizing, and even destructive levels of poverty. And like one of the at least a number of the statistics that really blew my mind in the days that led up to the formation of Buddhist Global Relief, you know, through searching the internet and reading of websites on the internet, I learned that every year, that close to a billion people, some 900 million people around the world, that's roughly 1/7 of the world's population, is perpetually shadowed by the hunger, lives perpetually in the shadow of hunger and malnutrition. 900 million people living in food situations of food insecurity. And the more shocking figure is that somewhere between 6 and 8 million people every year die from hunger and malnutrition and diseases related to hunger and malnutrition. You know, we think about the Holocaust that took place in Germany during World War II, where 10 million people died over six-year period, or killed by the Nazis over a six-year period. So this is like having a Holocaust taking place every year. And yet it would take just, according to what I've read, $40 billion a year to eliminate global hunger. You know, $40 billion seems like a tremendous amount of money. But if we consider, what is the amount that this country alone is spending on weapons and militarization? You know, probably it's around $1 trillion a year, at least $800 billion a year. So $40 billion is just a drop in the bucket. If we just cut the defense budget, we decide there'll be some people in Congress who are screaming and yelling, but we cut $40 billion to eliminate global hunger. $40 billion to eliminate global hunger, that's all it would take. It would be possible. So if one appeals to very rich people and see that they can have their wealth, my idea is that there should be a maximum income or a maximum amount of wealth that people can have. Maybe set it at $100 million. You know, if people can't be happy with $100 million, if that's not enough, you know, they'll never be happy with a few billion dollars. You know, then we would have much more wealth that could be used to help people emerge from debilitating poverty. I don't know if I really answered your question, but at least some ideas. Okay, here, and then I don't want to exclude somebody way in the back. Okay, but first.
Well, I'm sort of wondering about how people have an effect in the external world. So Donna says that causes and conditions that produce the world that we live in.
Oh.
And the value, one of the Brahmaviharas, is equanimity and not having aversion or grasping.
Yeah.
Yeah. What we can do, and we can help to spread the Dhamma to the people so that the world is a better place because more people have the same approach.
Yeah.
But how does activism work in creating more conflict and contention by going out and trying to change? It seems to me that the world is such now that it's going to have to go to its inevitable conclusion, its own collapse, basically, where people will then return to their more spiritual values.
Mm. Yeah, I think that the fact that, say, social conditions are influenced or determined to some extent by causes and conditions doesn't mean that the unfolding or development of social conditions is inevitably determined by external conditions. That, as I said, that the particular complex of social conditions in which we live is, in a sense, a reflection of the minds, a reflection and an expression of the minds of the people that constitute society. And so through transforming our minds, we are capable of transforming society. But it doesn't mean that we just, you know, sit back passively and think that by transforming my mind, developing more wholesome qualities in my mind, I'm automatically going to be transforming, you know, the political system, the economy, the social system. But there will be channels, organizations, means through which we can give expression to our values, our ideals, our aspirations, joining with others in collective endeavors to change the system. For example, to take one example, we take the impending climate crisis. You know, if we all just sort of sat back and said, well, the climate crisis, through the carbon, increasing carbon emissions, it's just going to go on continuing. There's nothing we can do about it, or all we can do is, you know, speak to our friends and neighbors about it and try to cut down on our personal consumption, our personal carbon emissions. You know, that won't be enough to avoid global catastrophe through, you know, the climate chaos. But by joining together with other like-minded people and, you know, through organizations like 350.org, the Sierra Club, the Buddhist Climate, Beacon, Buddhist Climate Action Network, and multitude, the Greenpeace, and a multitude of other organizations that are also working to prevent climate catastrophe, we can have some impact to some degree on policies, put pressure on politicians in order to avert at least the worst phases of the crisis. Okay, way in the back in the very last row, I think.
Hi. So
I think it would be helpful if you stood up and spoke loudly. I see, to get sort of the message of the Dhamma out without turning it into commercial spirituality. Well, to get the message out, to promote the Dhamma, doesn't mean that one is turning it into a commercial undertaking, or in the sense in which I was speaking about it, a commercialized undertaking. What I mean by commercialized spirituality is what we call a diluted and, you know, corrupted version of spirituality, which is promoting or sort of playing upon people's desires for some kind of spiritual realization or personal improvement in their lives, with the bottom line of duping them in order to extract their wealth, payment from them, or else from getting them to join a group, to become part of what turns into a cult by brainwashing people in order to get maybe confirmation of one's own sort of spiritual ideals and convictions. You know, I've seen this happening not only in the United States, but there seems to be something happening, I don't understand how it's happening, at a very, very large extent in Korea, of all countries, South Korea. You know, in the 1980s, we had the movement, the Moonies. A couple of months ago, I was invited by an organization in Korea They called it like a global spiritual gathering. They would cover my airfare to come to Korea for a weekend. It was in September. And I'd never heard of this organization before. Something like Divine Heaven Spiritual Renewal Organization. And so I wanted to find out more about it. So I went, you know, search on the internet, and I found some videos of, they had a similar gathering in 2014. And they had numbers of like spiritual leaders and spiritual high religious figures from all over the world coming for this. And I saw like Buddhist monks from Burma, famous Buddhist monks from Burma, Taiwan, some Tibetan lamas, Hindu swamis. And they came into the stadium for this gathering. It was a stadium. It must have had about 100,000 people cheering when all of these spiritual leaders came into the stadium. And they used these flashcards to deliver messages. And the message of this gathering was, sort of the theme of the gathering was, we all desire world peace. And so these thousands and thousands of Korean people in the stands, the grandstands of the stadium, would each be holding up their little colored card. Is there a name for that procedure? You know, so that each colored card, when you take them all collectively, they're spelling out the message. So the message is, we all love world peace. And then they invited the religious leaders of the world to get up to speak, you know, to give their little speeches. But then I read, you know, more about the organization. You know, I learned that the leader of the organization it's a kind of unorthodox form of Christianity in which they regard their leader, the one who's sending out the invitations, as the Messiah. And according to the text that I was reading, when each of the religious leaders from the other traditions is getting up and speaking, everybody is applauding enthusiastically. But the speech that the Korean people from the organization are giving are saying, you see how all of these religious leaders from the world recognize our leader, as how they have such respect for him, such love for him, such admiration for him, and so he must be the true Messiah. And their saying is, let's see, when light merges with light, victory is inevitable. Yes, please. Yeah.
You're talking about how the ego is completely self-ideated.
How
the ego is self-ideated, how we worry about ourselves most of the time, and how other people can help us, you know, serve us.
Yeah.
Do you think then that it's possible for us to all the time be empathic and worried about other people all the time?
I think when one gets to that state of mind, one is a Buddha or an advanced bodhisattva. naturally, as human beings still in the grip of what we call the three poisons or three fires of greed, hatred, delusion, or in the grip of the sense of I, me, and mine, you know, those thoughts come and we find, you know, these unwholesome mental states arise of, you know, jealousy, envy, competitiveness, ego grasping, a sense of rivalry, pride and so forth, arrogance. So those are, you know, natural states of mind that arise. And this is the point of our Buddha's training, is to learn to recognize these mental states. And, you know, even if we can't immediately eliminate them, at least to try to restrain their impact on our conduct, and then to arouse within our minds, to cultivate within our minds their wholesome counterparts, and then try to act on the basis of their counterparts. Okay, please, please.
My name is Bill.
Yeah.
I'd like to hear that. I don't find attention. I don't experience the tension you've been describing. It seems to me, in my experience, that one flows to the other. Personal flows automatically into the social.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot be not greedy, not
yeah.
hateful,
yeah.
or I get away from my aversion.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't understand,
yeah.
or I don't experience the tension you're
yeah.
talking about. Because if I'm going to feel compassionate,
yeah.
it follows I have to act compassionately,
yeah.
interact with the world.
Yeah.
If I'm going to be not greedy, then that is to deal with wealth, I have to act in the
yeah.
world.
Yeah.
So I'm automatically to
yeah.
live who I am.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the world.
Yeah.
So the two are always wedded.
Yeah. That's actually a very good point, and I agree with you. And when I use the word tension, I don't want to imply by that word that there's necessarily a conflict between the two. When I use the word tension, what I'm trying to point out is that there's a certain dialectic involved whereby, let's say, the pursuit of our own spiritual development, inner cultivation, how to put this? Overlaps with our involvement in the world. So, you know, as one cultivates oneself, this is naturally going to affect the way we interact with people in the world. But where a certain, maybe, tension starts to turn into a conflict or a contradiction is when some people think that the whole point of spiritual cultivation is just to develop my inner spirituality. And of course, that's going to affect the way I interact with others in my immediate environment, but that I don't have a responsibility to transform the systems that govern our collective coexistence. So then one has a polarization starting to take place between the pursuit of an inner spirituality with a limited social impact, and on the other hand, those who think that the way to change oppressive systems is to throw oneself entirely, without inner cultivation, into social, especially into political movements, aimed merely at changing the governing, those who are governing in the political system. Okay, maybe we have time for maybe one more question. Yes, please.
What would you say the most important thing that we can do as individuals to work against this inversion of value?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that for everybody there's just one particular project to which they could commit themselves, or one particular cause to which they should commit themselves. But what I found useful is advice that came from Andrew Harvey. He said that one should, after one has quieted one's mind, at sort of at a still hour early in the morning, late at night, reflect on some of like the major problems that are confronting humankind today, whether in the sphere of like, you know, the persistent wars, economic inequality, climate change, racism, the explosion of gun violence in the US, the way human beings are treating animals. Go over them in one's mind until one finds something which really pulls at the strings of one's heart, and then continue to examine, or to continue with that course of reflection over a number of days until one feels a strong sense of inner commitment to a particular cause, project, sphere of concern, and then start engaging oneself in that sphere of concern. Okay, I think we should come to an end. Now, I'd like to end in the traditional way with what's called the sharing of the merits. And so this is inviting the devas, the Dhamma-protecting deities, the nagas, the dragon spirits, the buddhas, the fierce spirits, and all beings to rejoice in our merits, and by rejoicing in our merits, to be free from all suffering, to be well and happy, and particularly for the deities to protect the Dhamma in this human world. Akasata cha bhumata deva naga mahidika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata cha bhumata deva naga mahidika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata cha bhumata deva naga mahidika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu mangparang. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe devanumodantu sabbe bhutanumodantu sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya bhavatu sabba mangalang rakantu sabba devata sabba buddhanu bhavena sada soti bhavantu te bhavatu sabba mangalang rakantu sabba devata sabba dhammanu bhavena sada soti bhavantu te bhavatu sabba mangalang rakantu sabba devata sabba sanganu bhavena sada soti bhavantu te. Okay, then you say sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And please also remember a sort of a final word from our sponsor that tomorrow we have the Buddhist Global Relief walk to feed the hungry in, it's called Volunteer Park, quite appropriate name. Okay, thank you for all of your attention and your probing questions.